child death rate was declining, education was going up, wealth was going up, starvation was going down. You know, by every metric, the world was getting better.
I am a husband, a father, a lawyer, a Christian, and a proud Canadian. I started this series because it was clear that our nation needs truth. Not just another biased narrative, but real information of substance. We need access to facts and the freedom to think for ourselves. I'm Leighton Gray, and this is Gray Matter.
Another episode of Gray Matter. Well, today on the program, we have a guest who I think you're going to find very interesting. He's an author and writer, energy policy analyst, and executive consultant for over 45 years. In oil and gas. But most recently, what he's done is he's written a very interesting book called From Miracle to Menace, Alberta, a Carbon Story. And I thought it would be great to have him on the program because, of course, as Albertans, we're getting so many mixed messages about, you know, about carbon, about carbon emissions and man-made climate change. So I'm very pleased to have on the program David Yeager, who is going to help us try and make sense of it all. Welcome to the program, David. It's great to have you on.
Well, thank you very much.
So before we introduce you properly, as we always do, we're going to go to our framing aphorisms. And the first one is from Alex Epstein, who's written a book on climate change and carbon.
He's on the shelf. Yep, you bet.
Yeah. And he said this. He said, the single thought that can empower us to empower the world, mankind's use of fossil fuels is supremely virtuous because the human life is the standard of value and because using fossil fuels transforms our environment to make it wonderful for human life. The second one is from another man who's written about climate change and fossil fuels. And this is Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote that global warming is real. It is man-made and it is an important problem, but it is not the end of the world. And these next two are from our guest, who wrote, the measure of the progress of civilization is how we take care of those who cannot take care of themselves. He also wrote, Alberta was settled by people who came from all over the world seeking political, economic, and religious freedom. All three are being threatened by the relentless growth of government and its intrusion in our day-to-day affairs. So who do we have on the show today? Well, his name is David Yeager. And as I said, he's been involved in this space for about 45 years as an author, writer, policy analyst. And he's also written, I think, I would describe it as a very courageous book and a prescient book because it was actually written 5 years ago. We're going to talk about this. But a lot of the things that he writes about in this book, which I recently read, are actually coming to pass. It was almost like he was able to foresee some of these things that are unfolding. So, David, welcome to the program. I'd like to begin, if we could, with maybe climate change 101, because, you know, we have this spectrum where we have people like Stephen, you know, Gabow way out on the left. We have people like Dr. Patrick Moore, who we've had in the program, way out on the other side saying, you know, there's no such thing as man-made climate change. And then on that spectrum, we have people like Alex Epstein and Bjorn Lomborg, Michael Schellenberger, and perhaps yourself, who say, well, yes, there's carbon emissions and there's a climate change problem, but it's not the end of the world. So I'm curious to know where you fit in on that continuum, and also maybe give us a basic explanation of, you know, what is climate change and how is it happening?
Well, climate change is a fact of life on planet Earth. It changes continuously. They call the people in the oil industry climate change deniers, but of course, oil, gas, and coal are dead plants from hundreds of millions of years ago. They're created by the most catastrophic climate change imaginable, you know, entire oceans that have been drained and the sediments on the bottom, entire forests that have turned into coal. When I was a kid working on the rigs on Ellesmere Island, which is, we were north of Magnetic North, and we went exploring in a canyon one day, and we found petrified tree stumps this big around north of Magnetic North at about, 85 degrees north latitude. So the climate has been changing. This was caused by the shift of the Earth on its polar axis. And so if you look at the part of the book and trying to understand this myself, where I'm sitting in Calgary today at one time was buried by about 2 miles of ice.
And really?
So, oh, yeah, you bet. And so that was the last great ice age. All that ice melted. This allowed it, and this is in the book, this is what allowed the Asian people to come across the Bering Strait. Or the Bering Sea, which was connected, and start populating the place. And the great glaciers have been receding since, now that we can live here. And I'm just looking out the window to the west up the Bow Valley. And now they're going up to the mountaintops. And then people have waited. When I was a little kid, we drove up to the Columbia ice fields about 40 years ago or more than that, actually. And the Athabasca Glacier was right down on the highway. And now, oh, wow. when you go up there, you have to take a tour bus. It's receded about a kilometer. So somehow, our modern world got so full of itself that we thought we could stop this. And so the question is so the people in the oil industry are climate skeptics, because of course they just deal with ancient climate change, like 50 and 100 million years ago. So they go, climate change? You know, I remember one time when this issue first emerged, there was a geological scientist in the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, and climate change. He says, we produce oil from the Devonian Formation at Leduc. We ski on the Devonian Formation at Lake Louise. So talk about climate change. So the question is, so when we're talking about climate change, there are no climate change deniers in the oil industry. The issue is human activity accelerating the pace of climate change? Right. You have to be careful here. Yeah, and so the idea is, that carbon dioxide is the catalyst in accelerating the warming of the Earth. And my basic study of science indicated, isn't that so much as humidity?
Okay.
And yeah, the ability of trapping water in the atmosphere. And so that's why, again, if you go in the desert, it could be really hot during the day, but it's really dry. And as soon as the sun goes down, it gets really cold. But if you get tropical climates where it's very, very humid, that it retains the heat at night. You know, for example, Calgary and Edmonton, even it's not intuitive that Edmonton would have a warmer average temperature than Calgary, because Calgary's further south, we get the Chinooks. But if you look at the year, the average temperature in Edmonton is actually a little higher, and that is because of higher humidity and the less temperature differential between day and night. So,
interesting.
So that is Nicole's notes on climate science. But somehow we got away, you know, the whole thing came out so the Cole's notes are, is climate change? Yes. The climate changes continuously.
Right.
Can we stop it? I guess, yes, I suppose that, you know, there's no, what I said in the book, there's no possible way that industrial mankind emissions are improving the place. I can't think of anything getting better. Because of tailpipe emissions and burning coal and all the things we do. But the real question in the book is, and I asked this several times in the book, okay, if this is a solution, I'm not arguing that it isn't, it looks to me like the cure is worse than the disease. This goes back to your quotes from Epstein, for all the things that fossil fuels are allegedly doing, look at all the incredible things that fossil fuels have done. The assumption is, if we can stop we can stop using fossil fuels and allegedly solve one problem with very little thought paid to, as Epstein and others have done, to the other things, the other problems that have been solved by climate change. And that, I think, that's where the hubris of modern society comes in.
Right.
That if we all say and think the right things and pay a carbon tax and persecute Alberta, we can change the world.
Yeah.
And I was able to find no evidence that that's true.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because you're saying before we started recording, you're talking about, you know, your parents growing up in the dirty 30s and
World War II.
And you know, living through the Vietnam War and all those things. How did climate change become the single most important issue in the entire world.
That's
why are we talking about
only the
so
Western world.
Obsessed
only the
with
Western
this.
One. Yeah.
Right,
only
right. Only how did Western this
world. Well, yeah, that was an amazing thing. Yeah. My parents, my great grandparents were sod busters in southern Manitoba, so they came over with a one-way ticket from the old country to the new country, got a piece of quarter section of land from the railroad and built a country. And so my parents, my grandparents came over as little kids, and my parents were born here. And
was your surname once started with a J?
Don't know, actually. It's the same word. They're very derivative.
Yeah, Jaeger is a German word for hunter. You probably know.
Word for hunter. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jarmer Jager, Y-A-G-R.
Yeah, Czech, yeah.
We're blood relatives somewhere. Yeah,
oh, nice.
Yeah, I didn't quite get as much hockey skill as you did. But no, I'm just kidding. But yeah, but anyway, so but that's where they grew up, and so mm-hmm. they grew up. They didn't actually either of them spoke English when they got to grade school at age six, and mm-hmm. Grade one, and then they grew up, and then Dad moved to Calgary because he was a chain smoker, but they said that the real problem was humidity. So he moved from Winnipeg to Calgary. But again, and then he got a job. He was an accountant at a laundry and got a job. Then they hit oil at Leduc in 1947. In 1949, there was an oil service company that was looking for an accountant. And, you know, the rest is history. We caught the wave.
Wow. Yeah, so you're generational in this.
Well,
in
generational, yeah. Second generation oil patch. But it was just phenomenal of being in the right place at the right time post Leduc. So this goes back to what I call the miracle. Most of my life was oil and gas was a miracle, and we ran out of it in the 70s. And then all of a sudden, I looked around. And all of a sudden, it was a menace. That's where the title of the book comes from.
Yeah,
I spent you know most of my life and my dad's life saying the miracle on the prairies, which was Alberta and the oil boom and finding more fuel and the OPEC years and the shortages and all that stuff. And then sort of looked around, about 7 or 8 years ago, and now the same fuel that Epstein referred to that was saving the world was now destroying it. But I had to get into, of all the problems we had in the world, and you went through a few of them. Again, my parents grew up during the Depression, the Second World War, the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, I remember coming home in 1962. I was in grade school. We went to see a movie that Calgary was a target, right, because it was an oil center. There was a black and white film that if we hid under the desk when they dropped the big one, we could stave off thermonuclear annihilation by a nanosecond or two. I remember going home. Mom, Dad, are we going to put a bomb shelter in the backyard? You know, no, we don't need a bomb shelter. We had an air raid siren in our neighborhood, for gosh sakes. They road tested it, blew all the windows out of the houses in about a two-block radius. And then along came Vietnam, and then globalization, and then wars here and wars there. And then all of a sudden we looked around, and the biggest single problem facing humanity was actually us. It was us. It was people. It was people and their determination to prosper using fossil fuels. So I went into the physics of it. I looked at the science side, and I concluded to myself that if I looked at and I read the book, a great book, a lot of books on the shelf about the improvement of mankind. And how things were doing better, and the birth rate was, child death rate was declining, education was going up, wealth was going up, starvation was going down. You know, by every metric, the world was getting better. We were using the cultivation per acre was going up, the number of people. And what I discovered was that if population was growth, what happened is as countries modernized and became wealthier, their birth rate declined. And so actually the population growth is a self-resolving problem if you're wealthy enough, because you don't need to raise 10 kids because three died at childbirth and to work the family farm. And so I ended up reading books on human psychology to fully understand this. And it started out with Malthus, you know, the Malthusian principle.
Right, like of course,
in the late 1700s when the Industrial Revolution was under its way. Was the population not growing more quickly than the ability of the world to feed itself? And then I discovered that other little nugget by Paul Ehrlich, the population bomb.
Yes.
And that was, he caused quite a stir. And that was the idea there. At one point, he said we should sneak sterility chemicals into the drinking water in the United States without telling anybody, to suppress the birth rate. Then it was Club of Rome in the 70s, and on and on and on. And then I realized that, and then a great book by Peter Foster called Why We Bite the Invisible Hand. Foster was an economist, but he wanted to understand why it was when the free enterprise system was the greatest producer of wealth, prosperity, peace, everything, why so many people either distrusted it or hated it. And the conclusion I came to was fear. Mm-hmm. That fear sells. Yeah. If you, I know the one chapter is they say the old saying, no news is good news. No, good news is no news. This is the reality. Is that, I had fun with that. Yeah, reading, I was a writer for years. You know, the headline, 7.9 billion people didn't die yesterday. No, that's not an eyeball catcher. You know, the world did not go hungry. Oh, dear. You know, but the other thing that happened in my career as a writer, we bought the magazine in 1979. So I grew up in the old media, you know, with fact checkers and competitive and facts mattered. And then the other thing, the other factor that came along was the internet. And the internet changed everything. The internet, the biggest thing impact the internet had on the media was it vacuumed up all the advertising. You know, if you think about a newspaper, when the newspapers were this thick, well, that's because the classified ad section was huge. Yeah. And, you know, it was like the most profitable thing a newspaper could print was the want ads and the classified ads and the personnel sections. So as the internet grew, the ad base of the traditional media suppliers started to deteriorate. And what that did caused the editorial departments to shrink. And so I saw that over the course of my writing career, where all of a sudden fact checkers were disappearing and more online sources. The other element of the internet is there was no censorship in the traditional media that I grew up with and most of us grew up with. Facts were a badge of honor, you know, the truth.
Right.
The truth was that you had fact checkers and so on. And the media was sensitive to this because if you didn't like what you were seeing, you would cancel your subscription. And when you formally canceled your subscription with paid media, that meant the number of eyeballs reading your paper would go down. That affected the value of your advertising, right? So this on and on and on. So now with the internet, anybody could say anything and there was no barrier. So you've got, on the one hand, you've got the proliferation of anybody wanting to write anything about anybody on the one hand, the shrinkage of the traditional media. And the thing was about the old media was that everybody read the same stuff. The media didn't really know who was reading what. So the newspaper, the 6 o'clock news on TV or the newspaper had a good cross section of everything, you know, a little politics, a little foreign affairs, a little economics, not knowing who was what. And so obviously the internet started to stream the screens, the news streams. And then, of course, with the algorithms in Facebook and so on, you can rig up your handphone so that you can just get nothing but what you want.
And
I was actually, this came out of a presentation from a pollster, and a presentation in 2013. He was saying why, this is just when the fossil fuel climate change movement was catching on, and we're talking about the millennials. And of course, the question was, do they read less? No, they just read whatever they want. So you can live your whole life on pictures of your friends and doing whatever they're doing. You know, NBA scores and whatever Kim Kardashian did next. The last element, again, the last piece was politics. And I got involved in party politics in 2007 after Ed Stelmach brought in the new.
Yeah, I saw that in your bio. You really took a deep dive into politics, didn't you? Became something of a political activist.
I did. Well, I helped create the Wild Rose Party 15 years ago, right about now. I was courting Premier Smith to run for the job. But what I saw
– Thank God you did.
Well, as fate would have it. Yeah, I stuck around with Wild Rose till Kenny won the UCP leadership. But what I saw in that 10 years from 07 to 17 – was the proliferation of social media to slice votes, to target votes. That all of a sudden you could find your tribe, as I call them, the single issue tribe. This was very hard before that. But now using social media tools and emails and stuff, you could say, aha. And then the last factor was urbanization. And that was a huge thing, that the migration of more and more people from resource extraction and manufacturing to big urban centers. And so that all of a sudden you had a whole bunch of urban voters that didn't really know where anything came from. Gasoline came from the pump on the corner. Food came from the grocery store. Power came from the wall. And this is the what the trend that we saw in the United States. There were voting patterns on the West Coast and the East Coast where the people lived, and we saw this. So all of a sudden, it all came together with the young people growing up. Climate change was alarming. You know, life's been good, but it was quite terrifying what everybody said. You know, you're all going to die if you don't do something else. Well, there's nothing that gets anybody's attention greater than their own mortality.
Yes.
People pay attention to that. Yeah, do this or you will die. Oh, who's saying what? So all of a sudden, you got a whole bunch of new voters growing up in the city, and you discover that on a certain platform, I can form the government. And in Canada, you can form the government with Toronto, Montreal, and the Lower Mainland of BC, and I can do that on the backs of climate change. I can say that, you know, the sooner we get out of the oil business, the best, the better. The sooner we get out of this business, you don't need any understanding of who pays for what. And that was it. That's what happened after Trudeau got elected. And and that's when I said, you know, this is all – that's when I wrote the book. I said, everybody's saying to Alberta, well, you should get out of the oil business. Well, they don't understand. That's why I say Alberta, a carbon story. Like Alberta without oil is Manitoba with mountains. There's nothing here. And so why do 4 million people live in Alberta and nobody live anywhere near it? Well, because we've got absolutely staggering quantities of oil, coal, and natural gas. So all I wanted to do when I wrote the book was I said, okay, you're telling what we should do. We don't need you anymore. You should all be solar panel installers. And fossil fuels is ancient history. All I wanted to do to write the book was understand that if you're successful at putting Alberta out of the oil business, you're going to have $2 million economic refugees and a bankrupt country. If you know that, then fill your boots. Yeah. So sorry to take so long.
No, that's brilliant.
That is why I wrote the book. That's what spurred
and this,
me.
This kind of leads me to my next question. And because one of the things that I've puzzled over, and you provide an explanation for this in your book, is why is it that climate change, which on the face of it is a scientific question, presumably with scientific answers, is always translated into an economic problem, which focuses on an attack, a leftist attack on capitalism, which provides essentially green Marxism as an answer. Why is the argument being translated in that way? I know you talk about it in this book, but I think this is something many people wonder about.
Well, the focus I took on the book in the book was the focus I took on the economic side. First of all, Conrad Black is the one who has articulated the fact that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, all the socialists showed up on the climate file.
Yes.
This was where the progressive showed up.
This is in the Canadian Manifesto, I think. It's a great book.
Yeah, well, and he writes about it in his columns as well, that he thinks that that's what happened there. My big issue on economics was that there was the notion, the science of climate was allegedly settled, but the science of energy was never even discussed. Okay. And what I mean by that is that a wind and solar panel and oil were interchangeable, and that was the issue I had. Was the fact is that you could, you know, as a transportation fuel, you can't fly. There's no such thing as an electric airplane or so on. And so what happened was is the combination. And Naomi Klein had written the big book you're thinking of. That's the one that I refer to about the link between climate change and capitalism. And that's why I say that what happened was is that the leftists, seeing that the fall of the Soviet Union and socialist governments weren't getting any vote, they migrated over the climate file, and they noted that the things they opposed, like free trade and growing wealth, which were opposed to their, were all fossil fuel powered. Mm-hmm. So that was the linkage between between the progressive or the leftist movement and wealth redistribution and fossil fuel, was they realized if we could get rid of the fuel, we could get rid of capitalism as we know it. And that's mm-hmm. how it was kind of an end run, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, the books I read on climate change and on human behavior, people like Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein, I mean, they were devout leftists. Wrapping themselves in this shroud of environmental protection, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. In the way you phrased the question, in fact, climate change was a means to an end.
Yeah, and it's playing out in real time right now in Canada with our environment minister, who's come up with this federal oil and gas emissions cap, which. Seems to me, based upon the things I've read, is both is dangerous both economically and constitutionally, and it's set up this kind of titanic struggle between our premier, who seems to me is taking a very sensible approach to energy, and this very climate zealot position that's being taken by the federal government, and so the stage has sort of been set for this battle. And I wonder if you could maybe explain why you think this is happening in Canada right now, why this federal government is so intent upon shutting down an industry that provides over 600, products that we use every day, that heats our homes, that grows our food. Why is this federal government so intent upon destroying oil and gas production in Canada?
Because that's where the votes are.
Ah. That's
no,
simple.
Tragically, that's why I went through the slice and dicing of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Is when it was discovered with using the modern screening tools and the urbanization and all the factors I talked about, when it was discovered that you could win an election on an anti-fossil fuel platform, there was a migration of the left into that file. And this is not unique to Canada. This happened in Europe. This happened in Britain. This happened in Europe. This happened in the United States. If you look at the way they voted on in California and the upper states, they discovered to their glee that they could. And oil's never had any friends. I mean, I grew up with J.R. Ewing on Dallas. As long as I can remember, I've never really understood how you can hate something you can't live without, like people feel about oil. I will not live without oil or any of its products, but I sure hate it. I think this is confusing to executives. Most of the time that sales go up. The idea that I hate this stuff, but I'm going to buy more of it. You can see why the executives, when the climate change issue emerged, I got to fill up with gasoline to go to the oil sands protest. No, but they were confused, right? All the modern business metrics, as your sales volume increased, you would say, looks like we're selling the right product. And it was very confusing to the scientists. That's why I said it was very much a fear, emotional thing, because the economics made no sense. The science of being able to replace, to make plastic out of solar electricity, that made none of that made any sense. I really had to look elsewhere. And so what I found was in the 2015 election, in that campaign, Justin Trudeau was pretty reserved on the climate file. He said he was in BC. Says, "Well, we'll shut down Northern Gateway. We'll get rid of the National Energy Board, the people that kept approving pipelines. Like this is really Bill's 69, Bill 48, the tanker ban, and then what happened was that worked okay in 2019." Looking back at 2015, kind of ratcheted it up a little bit. This is where they got more aggressive with, they passed Bill C-6948, but he got less votes. And I don't know, in 2021, I think they're sort of like a one trick pony. Let's crank it up one more time on the climate file. And I think, let's put Gilbo in this, as the Minister of Environment. But I think what you'll see now is they're really struggling because the whole climate change issue emerged in a really rare period of time. You know, the price of oil collapsed in 2015, which was a huge economic boost to the world. The price of everything went down. The price of solar panel manufacturing went down. The price of solar panel manufacturing went down. You know, they were able to pursue quantitative easing, like continuing to put money in the company, in the economy, but it was not inflationary because the depressed price of oil reduced the cost of everything. Right. And so they sort of we're in a period of time where economics didn't matter, where they were omnipotent. They were spending money. They were subsidizing wind and solar all over the place. You know, EV subsidies here, windmill right. subsidies there. And yeah. But the disguise of that was the cost of that was disguised by aggressive borrowing. They continued to increase the debt anyway. And all that's what I call the pre-COVID era. And of course, when I finished the book, COVID hadn't happened yet. But now I look at the post-COVID era, and all of a sudden they've discovered that years of underinvestment in oil and gas has caused shortages, that wind and solar doesn't work as advertised. Right. They borrowed so much money, they got runaway inflation, and interest rates are going up. And so what's happened with the climate fall is all the polling over the years has indicated I'm really supportive of carbon taxes and initiatives to arrest climate change, as long as I don't have to pay for them.
Right.
And all the surveys have said that. I have great interest in supporting the climate change if all I have to do is feel good when I vote. But yeah. as the cost comes in, all the surveys indicate, I'm really concerned about climate change. And you say, have you got $100 a year? Ooh, well, that's fairly big. If you got $1,000 a year. So the whole problem, and that I talked about this in the book, just didn't know when it was going to happen. I said, has anybody thought through what this is going to cost? Has anybody really thought through what it's going to cost to redo the entire global energy infrastructure, the global energy? This is a $7 trillion a year industry is the value of all the oil and gas produced. And so we were in it was most popular when nobody had to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And now that because it was debt financed, didn't hit your taxes, and the cost of everything else was going down because of the cost of primary energy.
Yeah.
That's all over.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
what we're finding is now that we're in the post-COVID area in the real world where people have to pay for stuff, they're falling like dominoes. I mean, the policies are changing. The EV mandates are changing. They banned drilling in the North Sea. Now they regret that. The Russian event, the Ukrainian, you know, with the gas from there. So all of a sudden, the whole world's getting a wake-up call. The two countries that are persistent in their climate policies are the Trudeau administration in Canada, the Biden administration of the United States. Uh-huh. And the reason they can do that is Canada and the United States have the lowest energy costs in the world.
Interesting.
And, yeah.
That explains a lot. That's a big question that I've had. But these carbon taxes are really, pardon the pun, are really throwing gas on the fire. And our premier recently tweeted out on March 5th, she said, Alberta stands with Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe in their fight against the unfair and unconstitutional region-specific and fuel-specific application of the carbon tax. She says, we regard the retail carbon tax should be scrapped. We agree that it should be scrapped and will continue to make every effort to see that that happens. So I want to talk about this carbon tax a little bit. And it seems to me, correct me if this is wrong, that carbon tax really doesn't do anything effectively to impact the environment, to improve it or make it worse. But by the same token, it does have a significant impact on the economic problems that you just talked about. Is that fair to say?
When I studied carbon taxes, I dedicated a chapter on carbon taxes. And interviewed Jack Mintz. I read up on William Nordhaus, who got the Nobel Prize on carbon taxes. Interviewed Trevor Toome. He's an economist, a noted economist at the University of Calgary. And I went around and talked about carbon taxes. In a pure, they cut this as market driven. In a pure in a pure market system, there's two things. Nordhaus concluded that for carbon taxes to work, they had to be global.
Right.
Everybody had to pay them.
Yeah.
And Stephen Harper was never that necessarily opposed to carbon taxes. All he said was, until our largest trading partner in the United States adopts them, we shouldn't give ourselves a competitive disadvantage. But the concept of carbon taxes is to truly change behavior. As carbon taxes go up, another tax is supposed to come down.
Mm.
So you've got you're punished by buying this to pull the price trigger. But should you want to switch to something else, you have higher disposable income in another area. I haven't seen a true conservative, economically pure carbon tax enacted. Mm-hmm. What the liberals decided to do was, yes, we're going to collect the carbon tax, but we're going to use it as another method of income redistribution. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is give you checks back. So in the end, there is no incentive to reduce your carbon consumption, because at the consumer level, it's cash in, cash out. What they don't understand, and I think the world didn't understand, is how the economy really works. Like during COVID, they locked down the economy, and then they tried to hit the switch and turn it back on again, and were discovered that, oh, that didn't work. You know, that wasn't a light switch. You know, that you, when you interrupted all the supply chains all over the world, you know, I'll be damned, because, you know, to do good politics today, there's just actually no economic IQ test required to run for public office, regrettably. Fortunately, Premier Smith, we've really hit the pay dirt on this one.
Yes.
She's really, really clever. She's got a degree in economics and very sensitive to this. So what Ottawa did was, they didn't look at the impact of the carbon tax on the supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the trucks came over the border as soon as they bought fuel, and they didn't really understand or didn't care how the carbon tax was baked into the cost of everything. So while you might get a theoretical carbon tax rebate based on your fuel consumption, say gasoline and natural gas, what they didn't do was a comprehensive carbon tax reduction, which included the supply chain, and they couldn't do it. And so, you know, for the trucking industry, for example, if they'd have said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to charge carbon tax on fuel, well, maybe there should have been a commensurate drop in something else, road taxes, GST, income tax, or something like that. There was other ways to make that carbon tax neutral for a transportation company. So they might have said, well, okay, well, I'll go get a more efficient engine, or, you know, I'll do other things. But they didn't do it that way. They decided that, and the other thing they do with carbon taxes is, you're supposed to let the market decide where the money from the carbon tax will be spent on decarbonization. But politicians are incapable of doing this. They take the carbon tax, and then they tend to put the decarbonization initiatives in the riding where they get the most votes. That's why there's no electric vehicle battery manufacturing plants in Western Canada. They're all in Windsor. And this is a flaw with carbon taxes all over the world. And, you know, the same thing in the European Union. When they originally came in after Kyoto, and I researched this in my book, when they originally came in with the carbon market in Europe, they found that come election time, the politicians just couldn't help but give waivers to the industries that had in their ridings.
Right.
And so we have never had a carbon tax in the pure sense, free of political interference.
Mm.
So the fundamental premise that the more, it's like anything, the more you pay, the less you'll use. And the other thing is, they thought that the inflexibility of demand for carbon, they thought that at some point that they could substitute, not understanding all the things they do with oil and natural gas, they thought that there were substitutes available, and there aren't. It's politics, not science.
Yeah, well, speaking of politics, as you know, the premier recently gave a very, I thought, persuasive, coherent address to the province. And she said some very lofty goals for the province in terms of restoring the Heritage Trust Fund, and also to really making the most of the resources that Alberta is blessed with. And recently, her Energy Natural Resources Minister, a man you know well, Brian Jean, he posted out, he was celebrating that at 3.81 million barrels per day, oil output in Alberta just had its best January ever. So the clearly, you know, the Danielle Smith government is going to continue to produce more oil. But the one thing that they're also going to do, and you talk about this a little bit in your book, is they're really committed to exploring this whole, let's say, uncharted country of carbon recapture of and making the most of that, and trying to use some of the byproducts of oil production, for example, gases like methane, and repurposing them to not only help the environment, but also to take advantage of the energy that that can produce, things like electricity. This is a very, very fascinating thing that you talk about. And I wonder if you could explain a bit more, because I think this is a bit of a mystery to many people. When the premier talks about, you know, things like, you know, carbon recapture and the whole burgeoning hydrogen technology, these things are sort of a little bit elusive. I wonder if you could maybe bring these down and explain to people what she's talking about.
That's the last chapter in the book. Alberta, there's three sections in the book: carbon history, how we got here; carbon politics, you know, again, how where this came from, all the things we talked about, and then carbon future. Right. And the reason I wrote what I wrote about what Alberta can do is that from a demographic point of view, it turns out that the decarbonization is really an OECD, a wealthy country project, but right. Only 1.3 billion people live in OECD, in the wealthy West, as I call it. They're not all West, Western economics.
Right.
And 6.7 billion people don't. And wow. There's an arrogance in of us in the Western world, in the abuse of we, of all the people of the wealthy West that speak for every living human being. And I've traveled. I've worked in the oil service business all my life, and one of the jokes is God didn't put any oil anywhere nice. So I've been to most of the places they produce oil. Like I've been to Southeast Asia and the Middle East and Brazil, and man, oh man, and they're so happy to have oil and gas. And so there, I just saw no evidence as the 6.7 billion people that don't live in the EU or don't have Trudeau or Biden on the ballot, they don't give a hoot, right? All they want is to get ahead. But I thought one of the things we could do in Alberta, the greatest contribution we could have, is being as how there was no practical substitute for fossil fuels. What we should become is a leader in how to exploit fossil fuels in the most environmentally benign fashion.
Right.
And this was the contribution we could do. We stay in the oil business. We stay in the natural gas business, but we become the leader in advancing technologies to still enjoy the benefits of fossil fuel, but materially reduce the emissions all the way along the supply chain. And that's what it is. That's what carbon capture, utilization, and storage is. There was direct air capture. At that time, it was just a fledgling business, and now that's going places. But there's also an enormous number of ways to do a little bit all the way in decarbonizing the supply chain. You know, one of the things they're doing today, for example, is switching prime movers for transportation from diesel to natural gas. Mm-hmm. That's a material reduction in carbon. And right. or else you would recycle water and use less water for fracking, or you would again capture carbon and store it underground, and all the things we're doing, or do more with hydrogen, or make more byproducts here instead of shipping the raw product to some place that doesn't have the emissions reduction standards we do. Do more processing here, and instead of shipping them crude oil and have them do high emission processing, do the processing here in a low emission way and sell them more finished products. I felt that would be Alberta's greatest contribution to the world, since we're not going out of the oil business. Now, this is materially different than getting out of the oil business entirely.
Yes.
but which is and that's why. And if you look at, you know, the liberals have really, I think, because they're a policy one-trick pony on the climate file, they've kind of painted themselves in the corner. They don't have a yeah. lot of policy options right now other than to say, yeah, I know we told you this for the do you know we had it wrong? If you'll forgive us, we'll do something else. The politicians don't seem to do that. So yeah. So anyway, I'm really excited. But I did, long before the Premier Smith got involved, I looked at the world. I wrote a business, an article for Business in Calgary in early 2021 that I'm quite proud of, not because I wrote it, because I was right, but but I looked around as the wheels were coming off in early 21. You know, oil prices were going up. Mm-hmm. We hadn't even had the electricity shortages in Europe yet, nor the Russian invasion or all those things. But I looked at the post-COVID world with rising inflation, rising energy prices, and I just sort of predicted that the world was going back to the basics. And the basics are food and fuel, the two things you can't live without. That in the end, that, you know, remember during this period, the tech bubble, that all of a sudden the stocks that went up had no cash flow. You know, there was the market. I mean, it was everybody, the fossil fuel divestment movement. Well, it was really easy to dump your oil and gas stocks after the price collapsed. You know, you weren't being that heroic when you got rid of these companies as they experienced financial difficulty. But there was this migration into more and more sectors, tech sectors, without cash flow. And I, as a longtime corporate finance guy, I just didn't think this worked. So I predicted in early 2021 that Alberta was going to be the place to be. We were going to make a big comeback because we sold the stuff. I don't care what the politicians said. We sold the stuff you can't live without, which is food and fuel. And when Danielle Smith won the UCP leadership, we had been, I had a long time, all the time working together. I had been her, one of her go-to energy policy people. And that's really the bond we had was energy policy. And when she won the leadership, she phoned me back and said, Dave, I'd like some help on energy policy. And I was obviously thrilled, you know, congrats. Yeah. Hey, boss, we made it. It only took 54 at that time, 14 years, nothing to do with it. but anyway, the point was, I told her in the fall of 22, I said, I think Alberta's got the wind at its back to a lot greater degree than you appreciate. And I was just watching world events, watching the policy changes in Europe, the policy changes here. And I think people are realizing, like, for example, you know, we don't have really plane loads of really famous people going to fly into Fort McMurray and trashing the place. And that's a badge of honor. You know, they've got better things to do. The oil sands have gone from the end of the beginning of the end of life on Earth to, holy cow, 3.5 million barrels a day right in the middle of North America. Damn straight. Nobody can get at this. Security of supply. So the issues of a previous generation that I grew up with, you know, security of supply, price control, affordability, reliability, were starting to creep back into the vernacular of energy. And they had been gone, that period I was talking about, that pre-COVID period where everything was good and everything was cheap and energy was cheap and capital was cheap and interest rates were low. We're back into a period of time where people were more concerned that the lights came on, not where the electricity came from. And that is the era we're in today.
One of these things that's really exciting about your chapter on where we go from here is that not only is it great to do things for the environment in terms of things like carbon recapture and development of hydrogen, but it's incredibly profitable, has a very high profit potential. That's one thing that's really great because, of course, that means that the province is richer. It means Albertans are richer, and that's great. But I wonder, you know, with that greenwashing or what the left calls greenwashing, is it difficult to sell this idea to the people who are in the oil industry, the producers? Even though it seems that a lot of the infrastructure we would need to do the things you talk about in your last chapter already exist. Are you finding that that the guys in big oil companies are signing on to this stuff, or is it a hard sell?
It's an economic issue. They're knuckle dragging capitalists, and if they get a better product, they'll make more money. You know,
right.
The issue is that the challenges on the producers of the 21st century are more complex than people understand. Like everybody sees profits coming back. There's a lot of forces at play. You know, there's the fossil fuel divestment movement. What does that mean? Well, that got a lot further than people realize. You know, banks, for example, it's a badge of honor. I can't lend money to fossil fuels.
Yes.
And so that are equity markets. I can't own shares in fossil fuel companies. Yes. You know, that has really, really clobbered the junior sector in Alberta. I mean, the junior sector was always a major activity. So what has happened because of that phenomenon, the fossil fuel divestment movement, ESG investing, is more of these companies believed that to survive, they could carry very little debt.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine if home buyers could carry very little debt. Nobody could buy a house, right? I mean, debt has been a fundamental building block of growth for years, right?
Yes.
And so
private debt, yeah.
Well, private debt, yeah. Private debt, not public debt, but private debt, and whether you're publicly traded or not. So all of a sudden, there's people that can't buy your stock because you produce fossil fuels, and the bank won't loan you money. And then, so that's one factor. So you have to, as much as these companies appear to be profitable, our capital markets coming back. It's reversing itself. You know, the Black Rocks and the Larry Finks of the world at BlackRock, when he could sell more bonds or get more investors by saying fossil fuels were dead. He wrote that. Now he's misquoted himself. He sees the wind. Yeah, there's nobody better salesman than an institutional fund manager. Those guys are lethal. They are the best salesman in the world because that's the highest paying sales job in the world. So that's coming back a little bit. We're seeing some room there. And then even the Canadian banks went, well, Mark Carney and the checking the boxes on ESG. So they're looking at to continue the capital markets. They have to pay attention, but they also don't have the financial flexibility they would have, because certainly coming out of COVID, a lot of them spent a lot more money paying down debt than building their company or investing in decarbonization. Hopefully that's stabilized. Another era is this emission caps from Ottawa. What is that going to cost? Like, who knows, right? When is it going to end? The Alberta government is being expected to contribute. Well, then Ottawa is that. So this is way more show than go in terms, we want you to do this. And they give Gilbo an open mic and he says this and he says that. That is a big cloud if you're an oil and gas producer. And the people say the world will be better when your business doesn't exist.
No.
How many businesses face that, in your town or mine? I say you come out of school and you say I want to be a plumber. Well, yeah, but there's an anti-plumbing movement here. Or I want to be a carpenter. Well, no, there's an anti-construction movement. I don't think there's very many businesses outside of tobacco and alcohol and maybe arms. Yeah. Now the arms business is picking up because of international conflict.
Yeah.
So you're sitting in a business that the world has spent in increasing volumes or increasing decibels telling you the day you don't exist, the world will be a better place. It's sort of like the abandoned well cleanup business. They said, well, you got to clean up your wells. But you're trying to put us out of business. And then wait a second here. The idea is that if you do go out of business, what you'll do is instead of paying your statutory deductions to Revenue Canada so you don't go to jail, you'll go clean up an old well site. No, the demands on the cash flow. They want higher operating costs, higher taxes. So these companies appear to be profitable, but there's a level of uncertainty that is impairing the way they spend their money. I believe that the industry has the technical knowledge, has the cash flow, and once we settle a few of these things down. So when it takes a while, when you spend, in my view, when you spend going back to 08, the start of the tar sands campaign, going back to Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, in 2006. That was 18 right. years ago. It takes a long right. time when the mantra is going in one direction of destroying the business. And then you wake up one day, say, well, we want to keep you around in a different form. There's mm-hmm. It's going to take a little more time for these macro uncertain events to become less uncertain. Right. At which point yeah. the boards will start making, you know, making the commitments for longevity.
Yeah. yeah. One so last question, Dave, yeah. Just along that line, it seems to me that the situation you just described in terms of the federal government's attack on oil, on the oil and gas industry, and how that's impacting producers and the economy generally, it now has become interwoven with the whole sovereignty issue that the premier and her government have sort of unfolded. It seems as though they're interconnected. That is, Alberta's energy sovereignty is directly tied to its political sovereignty, and that the federal government is sort of executing overreach in the economic realm in terms of oil and gas, and in the same way that they're exercising overreach politically, constitutionally. Do you see this as being by design or sort of an accident of history, the way this is unfolding right now?
This is not new. That if you go back to the National Energy Program, where a group of voters here said, go get those guys. This yeah. isn't a new phenomenon, mm-hmm. But I do see certainly in Alberta and Saskatchewan, enough's enough. I mean, they passed legislation. There's been a court challenge against Bill C-69, and they've won. Mm-hmm. There's been challenges of the Emergency Act overreach.
Yes.
And so this government and this act, but actually back in the National Energy, back in the 70s, nobody remember this, but for example, the federal government under Trudeau introduced a natural gas export tax. So the province
of Alberta, the first Trudeau. I call him Trudeau, Jaws. Yeah. I call this one Jaws too.
Yeah, well, anyway. But
just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water.
Premier Lougheed at that time drilled 3 gas wells on the Canada-US border and started exporting the gas. That. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And they took the federal government to court and had that natural gas export tax declared unconstitutional. So they do this brilliant. All the time. You know, in Ottawa, when they, you know, they get the big majority, and this disrespect for the constitutional and provincial rights is not new. Yeah. But what we've seen now with the behavior of the UCP government, now that they're back in. Certainly the NDP and the Liberals went hand in hand to the COP conference, the Paris conference, and agreed to everything with disastrous results for the province and the country. And so what we're seeing is constitutional pushback, and actually there's a great deal of support on Bill C-69 and the federal overreach at multiple levels. And so I think that at this particular time, more and more people are enough's enough. But for other reasons, there's more people in other parts of Canada, like for years in Alberta, what's that noise? What do they want now? But what they're starting to do, because of the economic squeeze, more and more people are waking up to the fact, well, maybe maybe these Liberals aren't the sharpest tool in the shed. You know, maybe maybe they're doing things that are affecting the entire economy, right? And so they're waking up. And the recent polling is, while it's encouraging for those of us that would like to see a change.
Yeah, they've got a 1% chance of getting reelected right now.
Well, actually, this is the same boat Trudeau was in in the early 80s when he had the National Energy Program and high inflation and high taxes and people were struggling. And then, of course, in 1984, the Mulroney government had the largest landslide in history. Mm-hmm. And so they haven't learned much, in the cycles.
40 years on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they haven't caught on too much on the cycles of Canada. You just cannot run a long-term federal government on the backs of the Canadian economy.
Yeah. You've seen this unfold during the course of your career. And yeah, I, for one, well, I'm twice, very, yeah. I'm very, very grateful that we have people like you around, you know, giving advice to our government. This has been a great conversation. I've been very, very pleased to have you on and to have learned so much.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah.
We're going to turn now to our reading list. So I want you to think of, there's a lot of books behind you, and obviously you've mentioned a number of different books. I wonder if you wouldn't mind just dipping back in your mental Rolodex for a couple of books that you could recommend to our viewers and listeners that would sort of enhance their understanding of some of the things that you talk about. But before, while you're thinking about that, I'm just going to mention the two books that we're going to feature on our show. Obviously, the first book is yours. It's called From Miracle to Menace. And it's you describe it, you say it's a miracle. Coal, oil, and natural gas are the carbon-based fossil fuels that powered the Industrial Revolution and civilization's rapid advancement. You say a menace. Climate change has now convinced many that carbon emissions are the world's greatest challenge. And you talk about these problems, as you explained in, during our hour with you, about how the, all of this has arisen, how it's unfolded. But what's great about your book, and I really appreciate, is you also talk about solutions and actually how climate change actually could turn out, if it's managed properly and wisely, it could turn out to be very, very beneficial to Alberta politically, economically, and even culturally, because of course, you know, as you say in the book, everything flows from prosperity, right? Our culture, arts, all those things. The other book that I want to mention is one that you've obviously read. It's the Alex Epstein book called Fossil Future, Why Global Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. This is a book that was written a couple of years ago. It's along the same lines as your book, but has a bit of a different focus. But the description here is, for over a decade, philosopher and energy expert Alex Epstein has predicted that any negative impacts of fossil fuel use on our climate will be outweighed by the unique benefits of fossil fuels to human flourishing, including their unrivaled ability to provide low-cost, reliable energy to billions of people around the world, especially the world's poorest people. And so I thought this book would be a good companion to yours, David, because you're talking about the same subjects, but you go in different streams. And also yours is so specific to our country and Alberta. And so that's actually one of the things I really appreciate about your book. It's written by somebody who knows a lot about our province, who loves our province, and really sees the huge potential for Alberta going forward. So anyway, those are the two books that we're adding to our reading list. And so I turn it over to you, sir, and I know that you'll have some great selections for us.
The one book I'm reading right now is How the World Really Works by Vaclav Smil. And he is a professor at the University of Manitoba, and he is one of the world's leading experts on energy transitions. And I'm just working through the chapter on food, and he calculates the diesel fuel equivalent of how much energy goes into a greenhouse tomato or farmed fish or grain and so on. And he was one of the few people that claims one of the greatest inventions of the 21st century was nitrogen-based fertilizer made from fossil fuels, ammonia. Wow. using the Haber-Bosch process.
Federal government's trying to get rid of. Yeah,
well, they're trying to tax it more. He figures that 40% of the population of the world is supported by food grown with fossil fuels directly as a fertilizer, and indirectly, of course, through mechanization, transportation, mm-hmm. and refrigeration. And then the other book, which is on the shelf behind me, I just remember the title, is called Unsettled by Steve Coonan. And he was, I believe, in the Obama administration, one of the federal administrations. He was a science officer. But what he looks at, you know, they say the science is settled. And Stephen Coonan wrote this book called Unsettled. And he has dared to dive into what Vaclav Smil talks about is energy science. Like, he's not questioning that if you put enough goop in the air, it'll change the climate. He doesn't dispute that, but he really understands what Coonan has done. And again, he too is not necessarily, and unsettled is the title, Steve Coonan. He's not suggesting a game that if we continue unabated smokestacks. I mean, you know, look at the progress that's been made. One of the greatest developments in life in living was when Alberta Gas or BC Gas replaced coal in the Lower Mainland and wood for heat in Vancouver. Saved lives. Mm-hmm. Same thing as that. You know, same as London. I have Coonan's book as well, Unsettled, and the climate change anti-fossil fuel crowd hates them both. Not. They don't argue with the. They don't argue with the words. They're just disappointed that more and more really, really smart people are weighing in and questioning whether or not. And I've done this with people in the renewable business. I said, and I've talked to people who build these things, don't you think wind and solar are just a little bit oversold as the solution to everything? And there are people are coming around to that, both in two directions. So two other books, How the World Really Works, Smeal. Unsettled, Coonan. Have a look. You'll be there in. They're a little more modern than those two books because Epstein's book was already out. I quoted him in mine, but these two are fairly fresh.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for those selections.
Oh, what David. Fun! To talk about my favorite subject is just an opportunity, a pleasure and an opportunity. And,
yeah. Well, we've learned so much. I mean, you've, pardon the pun, you've really cleared the air on a lot of this stuff. And I strongly recommend your book to people. One thing that I would say to people is, and I think some people are scared off of books about this problem, like climate change, because it is a scientific subject and some of the language is strange. One thing I found about your book is I found it's very, you've done a splendid job of making all of the sort of the scientific and economic concepts very digestible, even to a lay reader, even to a dumb country lawyer like me. And so I'm confident that anybody reading it is going to come away with a lot better understanding of the kind of things you've been talking about today with us.
I've tried to do that for 45 years, is make complex subjects comprehensible.
Yeah.
And thank you very much. Well, on the plug, if you want to find the book, I got some in the basement. If you want an autograph copy.
I would love that.
Well, there's a website. There's a website, From Miracle to Menace. It will get you a hold of me, and I've got some in the basement.
Yeah. We'll provide that link.
And the other, obviously, if you just Google the title of the book, that's available on Amazon, you know, in multiple formats if you want a digital copy. And I make a little modest royalty. What I can say to all the people out there is if you want to get rich really slowly, like never, write a book saying nice things about fossil fuels. I couldn't. It's self-published because I couldn't get a publisher. Nobody wanted to touch it with a barge.
Well, it's obvious you didn't write the book to make money. You did it as I see it, because you wanted to provide a public service.
It needed to be done. I had a real good career in the oil service business. I was able to work in the oil patch before it was a crime against humanity. And, you know, we had, like I say, that was the miracle and caught the wave, and it was all great fun. And now I've got an opportunity to give back to the province that gave so much to so many. And I'm
sincere. Well, we're very grateful for it, and we're grateful for your time today. And we're also grateful for your service to our province.
Well, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure having you on our program today. Thanks very much for being our special guest.
Have a great day. Thank you.